And my very first job after graduating, people say, like, what on earth do you do with a French degree? Well, I sold wine. I was a wine wholesaler. Each of the companies is trying to identify the area that they think is going to make the biggest difference. And for us, that's clearly sensing. You know, again, we've been working at this for, again, the better part of 20 years. And now we're at a point, which is really amazing, that there are 30,000 people with some version of a Percept device, either the PC or the newly approved RC. Patients will benefit from everything that we've learned about brain sameness. Think about that.
Welcome to Stimulating Brains.
As a third installment of this podcast into key industry leaders in the DBS field, the following is our conversation with Amisa Reitmeier. Amisa is the VP and General Manager of Brain Modulation at Medtronic. In this episode, Amisa takes us through what the future may offer, with some aspirational commentary on several potential opportunities for DBS and related therapies. It's important to note that some of the opportunities we discuss here are currently under development by Medtronic or others, and also that it may still be in early stages without a concrete plan or roadmap for incorporation into a particular product or therapy offered by Medtronic or others.
Thank you so much for tuning into Stimulating Brains.
So, Amisa, thank you so much for joining this podcast as one of the first industry leaders that I get to interview. It's a big honor to be able to talk to you and for you to carve out so much time from your very busy schedule. So, thanks a lot for joining us. And then,
well, it's a huge honor to be asked. Honestly, when you reached out, I was beyond honored. You know, this is phenomenal. So, thank you.
Great. That's great to hear. So. As you know, to break the ice, before we get into the your work and industry, I always ask about your free time and hobbies just to get some sort of idea behind the person. What do you do when not involved at Medtronic and working in the industry? Any hobbies?
So I have two teenage sons. I've got a 17-year-old and a 19-year-old. And so part of what we do is just watch whatever it is that they're involved in. So they're both involved in sports and activities, so we sort of chase them around. My younger son is playing ultimate frisbee, volleyball, and basketball right now. So we watch him do that. And then my older son is a freshman in college, and he's heavily involved in triathlons and distance running. So we go watch him compete when we get a chance. And then my husband and I try to stay active. It gets, harder as you approach 50 to stay fit, but we do try. So in the summer, we like to spend time. We have the fortune to live on a lake, so I learned how to wake surf, which is really fun. If you've never tried it, highly recommend it.
You got
to give that a try.
So wake surf, is that wakeboarding with a boat? Or
So it's basically you take a boat and you fill it with water so that it sinks down low into the water and it creates a huge wave behind the boat, and then you can actually use a specially designed board to surf that wave behind the boat. So you don't have a rope, you're just surfing along behind the boat. It is really, really fun.
You don't have a rope. I have not heard about that. Fantastic.
You'll have to Google it. Look it up. It's really fun.
Okay, great.
Or I can send you a video.
Yeah, I love that. Of course. Yeah. Great. Yeah.
And we play pickleball. We've gotten into the pickleball craze, which, by the way, is big in the Parkinson's community too. There's a big pickleball for Parkinson's.
Great.
Because people of any age can do it. So.
Really nice. Really nice. Okay. So, yeah. And you live in Minnesota, right?
I do. Yeah.
Are you from that region originally?
Yeah. I am born, raised, will probably die here. I love Minnesota. It's hard to get people to move here, but it's hard to get people to move away from here because it's a wonderful place to live.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I grew up in very, very rural Minnesota in a place called Runestone Park, which is also worth a Google if you ever get a chance.
Whinstone Park. Okay.
Runestone Park. Yeah, and there's a whole story behind the Minnesota Vikings and the Runestone and why we're called the Vikings. That's pretty entertaining.
Okay, wow. We'll certainly do that. So maybe as a very small tangent, I did a high school exchange as a student with Minnesota. So I spent, I think, 3 or 4 weeks in Northfield.
Really?
And, you know, my mom was a local school teacher in the other school, and they had a exchange for years with Watertown in Minnesota, also small town there.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, she was there every year, I think. And
so that's fantastic.
Minnesota in my heart too.
Oh, I love it. That's excellent. Good.
Great. Okay, so going more into your fantastic career and very impressive mm-hmm. career, who have been your key mentors and maybe also the key turning points that really led you to where you are now?
Yeah, there are too many to mention, but two that were important on my DBS journey. One was Dr. Steve Osterle. So I got to know Dr. Osterle when he was our chief medical officer and chief technology officer for Medtronic. And we had gotten to know each other through strategic planning work that I was involved in. And he had been chartered to lead a project looking at brain-targeted drug delivery. So we were interested to know if we could use our stereotactic positioning capability to, rather than deliver a lead, to deliver a catheter that could potentially bring agents that don't cross the blood-brain barrier to targets in the brain and hopefully cure things that are currently incurable, like Huntington's disease or ALS or Alzheimer's, and then using our Synchromed pump to deliver those agents. And so I was involved, I led a project for 2 years exploring different ways that we might be able to do that. That's also how I got connected to Lothar. So Lothar Krinke was head of R&D at that time. He was super involved in business development, and then he was asked to lead the DBS business, and I had gotten to know him through this project around brain-targeted drug delivery. When he became general manager of the business, I basically asked him if he would let me run marketing for DBS, and he said yes, and that's how I landed in DBS. But Lothar was an amazing mentor for me. He's brilliant, obviously, as a scientist, but also as a business person. And he taught me, you know, everything about the business and about DBS. And he was amazing.
Fantastic. Okay.
Yeah. Great.
So, and any like key turning points beyond that? Maybe even how did you decide to work for Medtronic, or how did
I've always described myself as Medtronic's least likely employee. Because I have a liberal arts degree with a French major. And my very first job after graduating, people say, like, what on earth do you do with a French degree? Well, I sold wine. I was a wine wholesaler. So
I've seen that on LinkedIn. Yeah, fantastic. Okay.
My very first business trip was to Burgundy and Bordeaux to meet with our producers. And that was really quite mind-blowing for me. But I learned business-to-business sales because I was calling on, you know, I was a wholesaler. I was calling on restaurants and retail chains. And so I learned the business of sales. Coming into Medtronic was very much dumb luck. A colleague of mine who I'd graduated college with, we ran into each other one day randomly and started training for marathons together. And one day on a training run, he said, "Hey, have you ever thought about Medtronic?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, it's a great company. You should come work here." And I literally took a job that nobody wanted. It was contracts negotiation for pacemakers and defibrillators, and they were having a really hard time filling the job. So I came in and I just worked my way up through, you know, really through finding great people to work for who were willing to teach me what I didn't know. One of the things I'm proud about Medtronic is I think we're one of the best companies in the world at teaching people about medical devices. And so they taught me everything I know about medical devices. I learned here.
Fantastic. Yeah. And you have joined Medtronic 22 years ago, right? So that's a long stretch.
It's hard to believe, but yes.
And then have impressively worked yourself up continuously. If, you know, reading your CV is essentially a, you know, a success story that never stops, right? Throughout the years. Can you outline these stages briefly, and then also talk about what you're currently doing?
Absolutely. So in a nutshell, my first 5 years were in CRM, learning the business of Medtronic,
I'm sorry, what is CRM for?
So, cardiac rhythm management. Sorry, I was okay. in pacemakers and defibrillators. And I was responsible for contracting during the years when we were introducing heart failure as a therapy. So if your audience members know this cardiovascular space, they'll know the introduction of the third lead and kind of heart failure as a therapy. So 5 years in CRM and then 5 years in our corporate strategy group. So doing, I worked for the CEO basically doing corporate Medtronic corporate strategy. And then that business development role I mentioned earlier where we were looking at targeted drug delivery. Then 5 years in neuromodulation and the neurosciences. So 3 years leading DBS marketing, 2 years leading training and education across our neurosciences portfolio. Then back to corporate for a couple of years to do commercial strategy. And my last 4 years before joining DBS were in the cardiac diagnostic space, where I learned a ton that we can talk about if you like. But I will tell you, ever since I left DBS, it literally has been my dream to come back. I have been working towards and begging for the job I currently have for 10 years. So
okay, great.
It was always my dream to come lead DBS. And so when I got the opportunity,
it's a fantastic
field.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Totally. This is my dream job.
And can you clarify? I think so. Your official title is the VP and General Manager, so Vice President and General Manager, Brain Modulation at Medtronic.
Yes.
Can you maybe state what you do, what your typical day looks like, and
not much. No, I'm just kidding. So I have responsibility for two businesses. I've got the DBS business. And then I've got the Visualase business as well. So the comprehensive brain modulation portfolio. And there's kind of two different flavors of a day for me. If I'm in the office, I am coaching and mentoring my team. I have cross-functional responsibilities. So all the everything that it takes to bring our product to market and make sure it's available. So I meet with my staff, my teams, and make sure that we're all moving the same direction. But the days that I love the best are when I get to be out with our customers and our partners. So whether that's at a medical meeting or, you know, I get the chance to visit with our customers in their operating rooms and in their clinics to understand what it is that we need to do differently. So those are the best days.
Okay, great. How often do you get to travel and visit, I don't know, Yale or whatever?
Yeah. not often enough. No, I try. Okay. I mean, I try to get out. It's not quite once a week, but I am out a lot. Because, you know, that's where the ideas are happening and that's where the work is happening.
Sure. Yeah, it probably is important to just stay close to the, you know, end product in a way and the customers. But I'm sure other people of your team, maybe Robert Reicher, we could mention, get to travel more still. Is that the case? Or
It's pretty balanced. I mean, you know, one of the things I truly believe is our scientists, our engineers, our clinical researchers need to be connected. They need to be out in the field, meeting with customers, meeting with patients. And so they try to get out as much as possible. And, you know, it's nice now that the medical meetings are back. You get the opportunity for scientific exchange at these meetings. The COVID years were pretty dark.
Of course. You know,
virtual is fine, but it's not the same.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. On the other hand, a lot of traveling is exhausting, as I'm sure you know, and with kids and everything. Okay. So, maybe just to also further get an overview, how much maybe in percent roughly would you say you interact with R&D or the medical professionals that you just mentioned, or more the business side of things, or maybe sales? There are probably other domains that I don't even, you know, have on my radar, but can you maybe break it down in a way that we better know what it is?
Yeah. What exactly would you say you do around here? Right?
You lead the entire thing, right? And that is clear, but still it's, you know, I think for people like me or also, you know, probably other scientists, it's probably not even so easy to picture your typical day. So that is very exciting and interesting to hear.
Oof. Yeah. Well, I mean, again, so for example, the last 2 days, I was in full day sessions reviewing our plans for this coming year. And so we spent literally all day, you know, looking at spreadsheets, looking at PowerPoints, talking to each other about priorities, and everybody, you know, all the senior staff was around the table, making sure that we're all aligned on what it is that we need to focus on for the next year. You know, but that's 2 full days in a conference room.
Yeah.
But the week prior to that, I was, you know, in two different hospitals on two different days and visiting, you know, with our field. And so it can vary a ton.
Varies a lot. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And again, you know, my responsibility is to make sure every aspect of the business is working well. So sometimes it's quality, sometimes it's operations, sometimes it's finance, sometimes it's a customer issue that we have to deal with, you know, or that we
Putting
get to deal
fires
with.
Out I sometimes, say. I guess. Yeah. Okay.
But it's, you know, the variety is part of what makes it really fun. That's
why
I love my job. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. I think, makes sense. Okay. So, and then can you maybe paint a bit the picture of how Medtronic is generally structured, maybe especially within neuromodulation, but you've also talked about corporate. Again, I think many of us don't even know how these companies are made up and, you know, who are the key players and what do they do.
I don't even know if this is going to be interesting to your audience, but I'll give it a go. So we've got four portfolios within Medtronic: the cardiovascular portfolio, so that's everything related to the heart and its function; the diabetes portfolio, so, you know, essentially working towards the holy grail of the closed loop system, the perfect closed loop system for insulin delivery and glucose management; the medical surgical portfolio, so tools and instruments that make surgery easier. And there's a heavy focus in that portfolio on robotics and improving the elegance and the ease and the precision of the procedures. And then the neuroscience portfolio. So in our portfolio, it's everything related to neurostimulation, so pain stimulation, pelvic stimulation, and then and obviously deep brain stimulation, and then the tools that go around it, again, to make the procedure perfect. So what we call our enabling technologies, which would be the stealth planning station, the O-arm imaging system, bringing all that together into a perfect surgical plan so you can then do better surgery more efficiently.
And how strictly is it? Is it maybe divided in that part into hardware and software development, or hardware and R&D? Is that very connected, or how does that work?
So the businesses are separate, but the strategies are connected, if that makes sense. So my counterpart who leads that business, Linnea Berman, she and I are in regular communication about priorities, initiatives, making sure that what she's doing is perfectly aligned with what I'm doing, you know, and that we're advancing the surgical procedure.
Got it. Yeah. Do you get to interact with R&D yourself a lot?
Or all the time. All the time. I love it.
Can I picture that as you going to the labs and, you know, checking what they are doing? Or how is that? How can we imagine
that?
Well,
mostly when I go to the labs, I'm a distraction, to be perfectly honest. So, because they have to stop what they're doing and explain it to me, not being an engineer or a scientist. But my favorite opportunity to interact with R&D is when we host tech suites at medical meetings. So we bring scientists or engineers and give clinicians a peek behind the curtain at what's coming. I get to listen to those conversations and hear, you know, what customers like about what we're developing, what they think could be better. And I get to hear how our scientists and engineers are thinking about solving the problems. So that's my best and least disruptive way to interact with them. Mostly I try to stay out of the way so I don't break something if I go into their lab.
Got it. And then for corporate, that's the right word. I think in my notes, I still called it the mothership in quotes, but
we call it that too.
Better. Okay. Yeah. how often do you interact with corporate or Medtronic? I don't know. And do you, for example, for budgeting reasons, or if you plan a bigger project, you probably have to pitch it to, or your team has to pitch it to corporate?
So our senior president, Brett Wall, he's the president of the portfolio, the neuroscience portfolio. So we work with and through him. Brett is a phenomenal advocate for the DBS business. He's championed a ton of investment in our space. And so we work with him and we go pitch our CEO, Jeff Martha, who's also a champion for DBS, to try to get the fair share of investment. But, you know, maybe I'll say very respectfully that I try to interact with corporate as little as possible, as much as necessary, but as little as possible.
That makes sense. Yeah. So, got it.
Because, you know, our energy is best spent with the people doing the procedures.
Of course. Yeah. No, I'm sure. Yeah. And so, obviously Medtronic is one of the three big DBS companies in the Western world, and probably the largest, or at least the most, you know, established. I am sure the market is competitive, and you know, maybe also in the more recent history, that there had been maybe a bit of a challenging times, or at least, you know, not as fantastic times with others joining the market. That's at least how I see it from the outside. Probably one of your part of your job is to find exactly the strategies of USPs, unique selling points, of how can you create something that the other companies don't have yet, or so, right? And how do you maybe disrupt the market that way? First of all, is that true? And then do you can you share about developments that are maybe already public that you're most excited about these days that are coming
absolutely
or already happening?
Well, so you're absolutely right. Each of the companies is trying to identify the area that they think is going to make the biggest difference. And for us, that's clearly sensing and the path towards the closed loop. So this is a journey, you know, that we've been on for the better part of two decades. This is, you know, it's going to feel new to the market, but this is work that's been ongoing for decades. You know, when I first joined DBS in 2012, we had 20 investigator-initiated research studies all around the world trying to answer the question, A, can we identify a brain signal? And B, does it matter if we can?
Yeah.
Like, so what if you can detect it, if it doesn't make a difference?
Yeah.
And you know, there've been dozens of researchers involved in this work from, you know, all over the world. You know, some of the legends like Helen Bronte Stewart, Phil Starr, Michael Oaken, Peter Brown, Andrea Kuhn, you know, just people who were really early champions and pioneers. You were probably involved.
I did. Like, I was in Andrea Kuhn's lab, and I remember, you know, reading out the PC plus S signals from the very first devices. I think we even published the first PC plus S paper from Berlin, if I remember correctly.
Exactly.
I'm a co-author on it, but there was Julian Neumann.
Congratulations. Sorry.
No. But this, I remember also that the reps told us at the time, this is a major initiative for Medtronic now, and they, you know, they put a lot of investment into this. And I mean, it has been a success story now with Percept really changing a lot, but you should talk about that.
But that's exactly it. So, you know, again, we've been working at this for, again, the better part of 20 years, and now we're at a point which is really amazing, and that we're going to make it clinically meaningful for patients around the world. There are 30,000 people with some version of a Percept device, either the PC or the newly approved RC. Patients will benefit from everything that we've learned about brain signals.
Hmm.
Think about that.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. I agree. Yeah.
You know, and so for us, you know, the brain pacemaking space is getting to a place where cardiac pacing has been for decades. Yeah. Rate responsive, physiologically adaptive, you know, stimulation. And so making that real is going to revolutionize the brain modulation space. Like, I think 10 years from now, we won't be able to believe that we didn't do essentially rate responsive brain pacemaking or physiologically responsive brain pacemaking. It's standard of care in cardiac pacing, and it will become standard of care in brain modulation. There's still obviously a ton to learn. And, you know, we've just got now our first closed loop algorithm getting ready for submission to FDA. And approval, you know, so that it's super exciting. But that's where our strategic bet is. And I think it's going to make a difference, not just for movement disorders, but potentially for psychiatric disorders and other spaces in the brain.
Yeah. No, it's such a, there's so much opportunity. And then there's also a lot of challenges, right? And so many details to try iron out. I remember, again, when I started, it was 10 years ago, and research, it was always already about closed loop, you know, Andrea Kuhn, and like looking at the work from Peter Brown in Oxford. And it was, the ideas have been around for so long. And then I think there was 2 years ago at the think tank in Mike Oaken's DBS think tank, we had discussions about closed loop, and I really felt like everybody knows and seems, you know, no, this is a great idea, but then looking at the details, it seems like it is challenging. And
it's super challenging.
You have a really cool success story now. I've seen also the pilot data, I think was a poster at movement disorders or so.
In Copenhagen.
That looks fantastic. But you know, if you were to just to show the challenge, if you were to show it from the other angle, you could also say this is the simplest possible thing now, right? And that's probably also a theme in industry where you guys have to make tools that work, and that means usually, you know, the scientists already dream about, you know, maybe much more complicated things, but then these don't work yet, right? So
yeah, exactly. Now we've got to take things that are really complex and make them simple enough that they benefit anybody who wants to use it without having to, you know, download files and dissect little squiggles on a page. You know, we got to make it super obvious now. But you know, that's this next year, there'll be a couple of enhancements that we launch that dramatically simplify the value of brain sense signals for clinicians. And then of course, behind the scenes, there's still all the detail for the people who want to continue to do research on it, you know, now with a ubiquitously available platform, right?
Yeah. I mean, Percept has been at least as big for research than for clinical practice. I totally agree. It's been a bit like, even, you know, there had been pre-Percept, there had been these labs like that you mentioned, you know, Peter Brown and Dre Kuhn, but then Phil Starr, of course, and, you know, people that had the externalization set up and had it all figured out. And then I think Percept came in. So many people jumped on the closed loop wagon, which also shows how, you know, big of a role you can have as industry to enable research and empower just more brains on the same topic.
Exactly. Well, and that gets, you know, to the idea that the next thing we have to apply to it is data, machine learning, and potentially AI to be able to interpret the signals at scale.
Yeah.
Right. Because you can only do so much with human beings, but if we can get this to a place where we can scale the learning, that's great. You know, and the RC system gives you an important advantage, which is if you choose to stream that signal, you know, for 15 years continuously, you don't have to worry about killing the battery.
So, totally. Yeah.
So like for epilepsy or for whatever. Yeah.
Absolutely. Was even a potential ethical constraint, right, to not stream too much with the PC. So that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
I never thought about it as an ethical constraint, but that's a very good point. You don't want to force people into having a surgery
if you would completely drain it, right? That needs additional surgery and also cost, of course.
That makes sense. Absolutely.
Okay. Cool. So, are there any plans on the roadmap that you can already talk about? I know this is highly restricted, only of course to share.
So obviously continuing the path towards getting adaptive DBS approved for commercial use and you know, around the world for any place that has Percept, we want ADAPT. But there's more to it than that. So another area where we're putting a lot of energy and attention is on what we call insights-driven care. So taking the data that the device is giving us about what's happening with the patient when they're not in the clinic, turning that into reports, charts, graphs that give the clinicians insights into what's happened with the patient since they saw them last. So how much time did they spend in a particular group setting? Does it appear that they're having fluctuations that might be circadian in nature? Or can you tell that the medication scheme may not be appropriate based on their brain signal? So taking everything that the device can tell you and turning it into insights that can drive the care for the patients in an improved way. So that's a big area of interest for us. And we're working, we've now got beta portals being deployed that we hope to bring to market at scale within the next couple of years. So for us, that's
beta
very
portals,
exciting.
Meaning beta.
Sorry, not version, beta signal not, portal. Not,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Or like, yeah, sorry for so the confusion.
Where some clinicians can already test it. Okay, fantastic.
Yeah, and get feedback on making it simple and easy to use and useful.
Is that the same like story that the collaboration with Rune Labs as well ties into that, I assume, right? With Apple Watches and movement.
Yeah,
data.
Very similar. Yeah. So we continue to explore whether a wearables partner could be something that would be useful. You know, whether that wearable signal is complementary to the brain sense signal.
Yeah. It's a generally a fantastic idea to, you know, the clinician always has a problem that they see their patient only once. It's a snapshot in a month or, you know, and then, you know, they see them 15 minutes or half an hour. So not a, you know, big period of their day, and then to condense some sort of more of their day and weeks in, into metrics makes a lot of sense to me, right?
Yeah. Well, on the cardiac diagnostic side, so I spent 4 years in cardiac diagnostics. And when a person with a cardiac diagnostic device goes into the clinic, well, first of all, that data has been continuously uploaded to their clinician, you know, since they've been seen. If the device detects a problem, the clinician is alerted and they can proactively contact the patient. And then when the patient comes in, they see this elegant, beautiful report of how they've done. I'm inspired by that to bring that level of insight over to the neuromodulation space where it just hasn't been available. And then you think, you know, one step forward to getting towards alert-based care so that the clinician actually gets a signal when the patient's conditioning is worsening, when the condition is worsening, and then they can proactively call them in. So then instead of, you know, every 3 months you're coming in, whether I need you or not, if you're doing fine, I don't see you. If I see a problem, I bring you in. And then maybe it's, you know, it's as often as needed, but not more than necessary.
Love it, love it. So if, for example, if beta, you know, bursts get longer or whatever, or the beta power in general, so you would see that, or the fluctuations get worse, then there's maybe a, got it.
Yep, here's a signal that something has changed with this, with my patient. Come on in, tell me what's going on. Let's get this fixed. Or, you know, you could also imagine a future where there's fall detection. And if you see two or three falls in a 24-hour period, you see, okay, you know, something's not right. Bring the patient in. Right.
Love it. That changes the game. That's very cool. And you mentioned before in the intro that you learned a lot in the cardiac field and could talk about that too. Mm-hmm. You already mentioned it briefly. Is that exactly what you mean, or were there other things?
That's exactly what I mean. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Again, so this idea of alert-based care, care on demand, insights-driven care, taking the insights from the device and presenting it to the clinician in a way that's useful over time for the life of the patient. All of that is standard of care in cardiac and needs to become standard of care in neuromodulation. So it's
fantastic. Yeah. It's cool to have such a clear, you know, role model where it worked already. And then I'm sure that makes a lot of sense. It makes
the path my team launched the very first AI-based algorithms on a cardiac implantable device while I was in cardiac. And so that just gets me excited to think about what we'd be able to do with all this brain data that we have. Like, can we do AI for the brain in a not creepy way?
And I think maybe my two cents there, I think it has to go to long-term, you know, to not just switching on and off the same contact, but also even switching networks around, right? So I've been talking about that even here on the podcast quite a bit with people now. So probably the listeners,
all the connectomics and, you know, basically how do we better understand what exactly it is that we're doing when we're stimulating or what sending a signal? Are we stimulating? Are we suppressing?
I mean, if it detects tremor, it should stimulate the tremor network, right? And if it detects bradykinesia, then it should, you know, and it might, you know, if the patient is talking and can detect that in the future, then we should avoid the speech disturbance side effect network, right? So so I think there's a,
well, think fantastic if you could use like the accelerometer in the device to detect when a person is
walking,
you know, standing or initiating movement, and then you change the stimulation.
Yeah. You know, but not just on and off, right? But to actually switch between programs and maybe even different contacts. So I really see a fantastic avenue towards fusing these fields of maybe imaging and connectomics and the sensing and adapting between networks. So
And that's a huge part of the partnership that we have with our Enabling Technologies group.
Yes, you know, I'm sure.
So they have the DTI, they have the imaging, they have, you know, some of the most fantastic technology in the world for visualizing our leads. Now we just have to pull that over to the programming side.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds great. Fantastic. Yeah. So great roadmap. Then maybe... Yeah, on the podcast, I mainly speak with scientists and clinicians, and sometimes even had the honor to talk to patients too. But we haven't had many representatives from the industry yet. And you've mentioned before we started recording that you listened to the conversation with Todd Langevin, who was the first, really. And I have a few more scheduled and interviewed. So we both know that many academics continuously wonder whether life in industry could be more rewarding or, you know, more interesting for them. Do you want to steel man the case of working for industry? I think you have not, you know, worked much in academia, but I'm sure you know and talk to people and know what is fantastic about industry?
Well, here's a point of view I'd offer you. If you're involved in academic research, you have the opportunity to influence and to shape the standard of practice across an industry, which is phenomenal. If you're involved in daily clinical practice, you get the opportunity to improve lives one at a time, which is really an amazing thing to do. When you come over to industry, you get to fuse those things together and get involved in work that might impact thousands or hundreds of thousands of people by pairing the knowledge and insights that you have from your clinical practice or your academic practice and translating that into therapies that have the opportunity to reach, again, up to hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah.
What you do have to recognize is that working inside of a corporation has benefits and it has, you know, some things about it that aren't that great. But by and large, when I've talked to doctors who have made the switch to industry, they say they do it because they want to be able to impact more people.
Yeah.
And you know, we are the vehicle for bringing technology to market. So if that's motivating to you, it is a wonderful place to apply the knowledge that you have.
Yeah.
As long as you can deal with the politics of a corporation.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, sometimes bigger universities can feel like as rigid as corporations to mm-hmm. some degree as well. But I mean, I'm sure the smaller labs, of course, are much more flexible in what they want to do and so on.
Well, you know, Todd talked about the difference between startups and big companies, and that's definitely a thing. You know, the difference between small practices and academic institutions. You know, within Medtronic, one of the things I love is we've got these little microcultures, like DBS, brain modulation has a microculture. We feel like this little scrappy company within the big mothership, as you refer to it.
Yeah.
But we have the opportunity to tap into the resources of the big company to make our little dream come true. You know, so that's kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, I know. Fantastic. And I mean, I have yet to meet the person that switched to industry and regretted it. But you never know if that was a selection bias, right? If only people go there that are of that type, then they don't regret it. So it's hard to know, you know, but it's always
one person that would be interesting for you to talk to is someone who went the other direction, which is Tim Dennison.
Yes. Todd said the same, and I would love to talk to Tim. I actually had reached out to him a few times, and now he even responded and said yes, but he seems busy, so we'll see if it actually happens, but I would love to talk to him. Yeah, I think he would be fantastic on the podcast, too.
Yeah, well, and again, he was there for the origin story of sensing. It's, you know, it's amazing.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
He's still an advisor for me, by the way. He, you know, I stay regularly connected with him because he's doing such important work at Oxford.
So. Great. How did you overlap at Medtronic? Were you colleagues or
closely? Yeah, we were colleagues. He was in R&D when I was in marketing. That the first time I was in DBS.
Okay.
So all that work we were doing on the Brain Initiative, that was Tim.
Great.
He described to me brain sensing in the way that made the most sense, which is, it's like trying to hear a whisper over the roar of a jet engine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's always stuck with me. That describes how hard it is to do what we're trying to do.
Yeah. And I mean, especially if you use the same contacts or close to where you stimulate, right? I think if you have a paddle to sense on the cortex, for example, then it might be, you know, a bit easier. But do you have any opinion on that? You know, using a different site in the brain to sense? You stimulate? Is that a thing you guys are?
I don't know yet if that complexity is going to be worth it.
Yeah.
Because actually now with the SenSight lead, we have pretty good electrical isolation between the contacts. And so, but you know, again, if you're talking about network disorder, the question is, do you need to sense in two different places or is it reliable enough to just, if you know what's going on in one part of the circuit, you understand what's going on in another. It's, you know, fewer things you have to try to get to coordinate, the easier it is. You want as makes little sense. Complexity as necessary.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. So what is your feeling towards the general state of investments in the field of DBS and neuromodulation? Do we live in bullish or bearish times? I think maybe just as context why I come up with this is, so at the last DBS think tank, Cameron McIntyre, who, you know, has a lot of much more insight into industry than most of us, essentially pitched a talk, which I found very interesting, that we might be at the fork of the road where if we don't deliver more and show more growth, then investments might decline in the future in the field. Could you maybe share your thoughts on general how is the current state of affairs there?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I have a couple different thoughts in my head. One is, I would not be doing it justice if I didn't acknowledge with tremendous appreciation the big investment that Jeff Martha and Brett Wall made in the DBS business to bring the Percept platform to market. So yeah. Again, they saw the need to invest in a commercial grade platform for this and made a pitch to the board and a huge investment. So now we're capitalizing on that investment in Medtronic DBS space. Yeah. You know, we have to earn the next tranche of investment, and we'll do that through delivering innovation that really moves the needle, either because more people benefit and therefore a lot more people choose to get DBS, or we open, you know, new patient groups that might benefit. So I think we're in a little bit of a prove it phase where we've got to deliver and then we earn the right for the next set of investment. But there's also an interesting, and I'm not sure yet if it's helpful or not, but there's a ton of fascination around brain-computer interface. These yeah. little chips and, you know, like what Neuralink is doing, which that's a whole set of conversation yeah. we could have. But there's a lot of fascination with brain-computer interface. So what I would argue is Percept is actually a functional brain-computer interface device. So it's yeah. the computer's implanted, right? So we've got a little implanted computer. We interface directly with the brain. We send signals and adapt. But there's a ton of potential discovery therapeutic benefit in the brain-computer interface space.
Yeah.
I worry that the hype is going to suck the investment dollars in that direction mm-hmm. when it could go towards things like, you know, for example, DBS for depression that could have a nearer term benefit.
Yeah, and such a huge population as well. Do mm-hmm. do you want, since you mentioned we could talk about Neuralink, do you want to talk about it a bit or?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
Sure. I don't want to get into hot water, I think.
Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense.
It's controversial. But there's excellent companies like Synchron doing work in this space.
Yeah. Sounds great. And then do you think a next breakthrough in DBS is around the corner? If so, what would it be? You mentioned depression. Is that your hot guess or?
Yeah. Well, my goal is going to be to make sensing and physiologic response to stimulation standard of care across more of the indications that we serve. And I'm optimistic that with some of the most recent discoveries by, you know, Dr. Mayberg and Dr. Capel, the most recent paper in Nature showing a correlation between a signal we can sense
yeah.
and the presence or absence of depression symptoms, that gives me great hope that we can finally crack the code on depression. You know, that's been also a multi-decades journey with a lot
of course,
forks in the road, as it were.
Yeah. So,
but if we could find a really reliable signal that correlated with correlated with symptoms, that could be the game changer.
Of course. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just indication wise, maybe you as a private person, anything that you would, you know, not even think you'd go into, but that you would find interesting to work with, or where you would see a potential that could be a new novel indication that could be helpful?
Well, I don't know how much of this I can actually talk about.
Sure.
But Dr. Machado at the Cleveland Clinic has some incredibly promising pilot data around stroke rehabilitation, post-stroke yes. rehabilitation. And his early results are amongst the most dramatic I've seen for any application, you know, in my time with DBS. Yes. So if that could work, you really could offer something very unique to people who don't have another option for treatment. So anything around kind of neuro rehabilitation, neuroplasticity, neuronal regrowth, that could be, if that worked, it would be amazing.
And it's a huge field, right? Stroke mm-hmm. is a big field. Yeah.
The other area I think is underdeveloped and undertapped is epilepsy. And, you know, again, I was inspired in our cardiac diagnostic space to say, okay, if we can detect cardiac arrhythmias, could we detect brain arrhythmias? Could we you know, come up with a really reliable implantable seizure monitor that then also happened to connect to a stimulator that could detect.
Absolutely.
Seizures. You know, yeah. It's sort of like the next generation of RNS and DBS combined, but less invasive and more elegant.
Yeah, sounds great. Sounds great. I very much agree. Mm-hmm. And this might be another topic that might not be as easy to talk about, but what do you think about focused ultrasound surgery? And maybe from a business perspective first, because I heard from multiple centers that started fast that it even drove the numbers of DBS up, where mm-hmm. you might think it could threaten DBS, right? But I've heard from many centers, actually, including our own, but also Andres Lozano mentioned that it drives in more patients. And then, you know, some that come in for FUS would get good counseling and rather go for DBS.
Yeah.
Do you have any, you know, ideas on that or opinions on that?
Yeah. So what I've observed is, one, it's been a net benefit because it gets people who were otherwise unwilling to consider a procedure to consider being treated. You know, yeah. People with essential tremor, their biggest treatment is just coping. They don't, you know, and so when you get the idea that a procedure might be, you know, less invasive or described as less invasive, which we can talk about, all of a sudden they're presenting for care. They're saying, look, here's might be an option for me. And when those people present to a really good neurosurgical center that has DBS and focused ultrasound, they get the therapy that's right for them.
Yeah.
So I don't care what they get as long as they get treated and get the maximum benefit. Now,
yeah.
I also think that, you know, I'm going to channel a phrase that I heard at a recent conference. You know, focused ultrasound is just a new tool for an 80-year-old procedure. It's lesioning.
Yeah.
And so when lesioning is the right treatment, focused ultrasound seems like a great choice. But it's also permanent, it's irreversible, and it's brain damage. And so for many patients, DBS is a better choice because it's tailorable, adjustable, reversible if you don't get a benefit. And so, you know, I think for me, as long as people are getting an appropriate consultation and the treatment option that's best for them, as long as more people are getting treated, I'm happy.
Sounds great. Yeah.
But it's not a silver bullet. And I, you know, I get frustrated if people think it's non-invasive.
Yes.
It's permanent brain damage.
And it is. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I think, incisionless is the better word, but even that, you know, there is an incision deep down in a way, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I get the point. I mean, I think most, at least the colleagues I talk to, they would counsel their patients well and tell them this is not non-invasive, right? So they might be drawn in with that idea. And then again, you know, personally, I always wondered if, you know, if I would get a disorder at a specific age, what would I choose? And it's mm-hmm. really not an easy, sometimes easy decision to make, but there are conditions, you know, being already 80 and having unilateral tremor, essential tremor, it might be the right thing, right? And you
might
go home
right
same day, so it could be.
Yes.
And then, of course, in the more longer term disorders, I think the huge value is not just that it's reversible, but that it's adjustable also with disease exactly. progression, right? So you have new symptoms coming in. And that is then always hard with any type of lesioning in a way. Even mm-hmm. if, you know, because we could always make the argument, maybe we're just not ready of finding the exact right site to lesion yet. But if we had that, then, you know, but then the adjustment is still not possible anymore. And you cannot...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, these are dynamic diseases.
Yeah.
Parkinson's is a dynamic brain disease.
Yeah.
And you know, again, the perfect world is that you, if you have something that can be treated simply with a simple lesion, focused ultrasound is a perfectly good choice.
Yeah.
And it should be available.
Yeah.
But it's not a cure-all. It's just a tool.
Yeah.
It's just a tool to do a job. So.
Yeah. Makes sense.
But on balance, I think it's good because it's gotten more people to consider treatment.
I do agree. Yeah, I think another tool in the bank cannot hurt in a way. Yeah, I totally agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've been wildly successful in life. If you had to leave Medtronic, and I'm sure you don't want to, if you know Andy Horn made you leave, what would the next step look like?
Yeah. So my goal is to lead the DBS business for the next 8 1/4 years until I turn 55. And then I want to retire from Medtronic. And when I do that, what I'd love to do is to do one of two things, or maybe both at the same time. One is to work with med tech companies who could benefit from the advice of someone who's been in industry and help them grow their ideas into products that reach the market. So work with small companies, venture companies, maybe even angel stage, and just help them get their ideas to market. And then the other thing I would love to do is teach. So I would love to be a professor of something if I have any skills that people would learn from, but I would love to teach. Or I'd just go back to school. I also have this little fantasy to get a degree from Harvard at some point in time.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
You can help me. That would be great.
I don't think I can, but yeah, maybe by then I'll have more influence. But I think it's, yeah, it's usually...
You could be my PhD advisor.
Sure. Very much welcome to the lab, of course, if that is ever a real...
And then, hopefully by that point too, I'll have some grandbabies and I'll just spend time like cuddling my grandbabies or...
Yeah. What's since you talked about small companies and Todd that we talked about did something similar, I think in a way, what is fascinating about the small companies?
Well, you get really close to the people with the ideas.
Yeah.
And, you know, because again, you can count the employees typically, you know, on 2 to 4 hands.
Yeah.
But you're right there in the middle of helping solve the problems, find a path, get things done. And so working with the people with the ideas is the most exciting part. You don't have the bureaucracy of a big company. You just work with the people who get to make decisions.
Yeah.
And that's fun.
Really cool. Maybe to wrap up, also in the interest of your time, some rapid fire questions. Did you have any eureka moments in your career?
Oh, yeah. I mean, one of a story that I tell a lot was my very first DBS procedure. So in 2012, I got the opportunity to go to Brisbane with Professor Silburn and Dr. Coyne. And they invited me in to see my first case. And so this was a gentleman who came into the hospital in a wheelchair. And he had that moment during the procedure where they turned the stimulator on and he was holding a cup of water and his hand stopped shaking and he looked at his hand and tears start streaming down his face because here's this simple act that he was able to do. And the next day, Professor Silburn sent me a video of this patient doing what he called star jumps. So jumping jacks in the hallway, again, from a wheelchair to jumping jacks within a 24-hour period. And I thought, well, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life is make this possible. Yeah. For more people. And then he sent a note that this patient's wife had written a few weeks later saying, thank you for giving me my husband back and my children, their father back. And it's like, well, there's nothing else I could do with my career that would be more satisfying than this.
Yeah. Love it. I think many of us, even also the clinicians or the researchers have such a moment somehow. Right. I've also interviewed Patricia Limousin.
She's amazing.
And she switched on, did you know that? She switched on the first bilateral SDN case ever.
Just so phenomenal.
And it's such a fantastic story. I think also Pierre Polak is also on the show. Also,
I listened to that. Same story.
And I think both kind of say the same thing. And it must have been, they really did not believe what they saw, I think. Oh. You know, Polak said, well, but he's on medication. And she said, no, levodopa. Ah, and he was walking. And, you know, this was...
It looks like a miracle. It literally looks like a miracle. You don't even believe your eyes. Yeah. Really, I think nice. You were at the 30. So I got the opportunity to be at both the 20 and the 30-year celebrations in Grenoble. The celebrations. Yeah. Of DBS and just seeing both how far it's come, but also how far there is to go. And I loved the 30-year celebration because it really was, you know, the entire team from Grenoble there to talk about those. It was so amazing.
It was fantastic. Yeah, no, I totally agree. I was too young for the 20, I guess, but I was just starting off then, but it was, of course, very great for me to even got to talk to Professor Benabit briefly.
Me too.
Yeah, seeing them all and just celebrating that success. And it was fantastic for me to talk to Todd to see the industry side of that, right? Because that's a tale not told much. And I really mean what I said in the introduction, that we owe it as much to Medtronic in a way to make this a thing. Could have been, well, I mean, probably some industry would have taken it up at some point, right? But making it maybe earlier or putting it out there and that.
Well, it was really fun for me to hear those stories too. And again, some of the people that were most influential in my learning and understanding, you know, like Franz Gehlen, you mentioned Franz Gehlen. Franz was there. I mean, we would not have advanced the field the way that we did without his meticulous understanding of what was necessary for a successful procedure. And, you know, Steve Getz and Rob Rake, as you mentioned before, Paul Stepakowski, Scott Stanislavski, John Giftakis, like these are all people who, you know, have just been involved for decades trying to make this therapy possible. Mm. Really a phenomenal group of people. Lisa Schaefer, she was one of my early collaborators on the drug delivery piece. So it is, you feel like you're standing on the shoulders of giants being in this space. I feel bad because I wanted to make sure I mentioned this. My time in DBS was, my first time in DBS was marked by the early STEM study. So I got the opportunity to work with Professor Deutschel and Michael Schuchbach when that publication came out, which, you know, you think about pivot points in the therapy.
Yeah.
The early STEM study was a pivot point in advancing and accelerating the field of Parkinson's because it gave us confidence that earlier application of the therapy was massively beneficial.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that. So I wasn't aware that you overlapped with that study. I could not agree more. So I've, Günter Deutschel has been even a
I listened to your interview with him too.
But also, you know, we have not professionally worked together. We have a few publications together, but he's been still a very kind mentor for me for my career. I do have calls with him every now and then, irregularly, to pick his brain on what to do. And I think he's been such a fantastic figure to the field in Germany as well, but I would say globally as well. The early STEM trial, and then I think the New England Journal paper before that, just showing adding more evidence to the field. I think that has been a great service to the entire community. I totally agree. So, yeah.
Well, it was huge. And actually one of the things I was surprised at coming back into DBS is that there hasn't been more discussion about the likely disease-modifying benefit of early application of DBS. Because one of the most important findings from that study was that the slope of the curve of disease progression was lower in people who got DBS sooner. Yeah. And, you know, I thought it's a little bit of a shame that that hasn't become more accepted, that people with DBS, the sooner you do it, they do better. I don't know if it's less medication or, you know, more activity or whatever it is. Yeah. But they don't get as bad as quickly.
I probably also have the unpopular opinion that I'm surprised by the fact of how vehemently people hand wave the possibility away, right? I think I very much agree that there's not good evidence. The best evidence probably from Mallory Hackers and David Charles's.
Yeah, actually they've done a phenomenal
trial, but these were, you know, just 14 patients. But that we don't have more evidence is surprising to me, right? That this is not being at least followed up more. And I think it's been very hard for them to get funding. And I've had discussions with, you know, folks in the fields that essentially, you know, already seem to know it's not disease modifying without having any data about it. And that's not really scientific.
But, you know, I would argue that there's data that suggests that it is. And it's
suggestion, yes. But it's not hard evidence, right? And I think, I don't know. It seems like we had, again, think tank is great for these things, but we had another discussion on that. And again, I was probably one of the few that voted for at least looking into it more, right? Mm-hmm. I think we do, of course, the argument is always to implant early can be dangerous and putting people at risk. So it's an ethical problem, but we have IRBs for that, right? We can see if it's ethical to do it or not.
Yeah.
And then I think we do a lot of things like, you know, for example, probing Alzheimer's disease or so, that are also not at all clear whether mm-hmm. they will help. Mm-hmm. So I, as a
scientist, yeah, I listened to your discussion with Todd about that with great interest, because again, when Todd was at Functional Neuromodulation was when I was in DBS, and we were really debating, you know, does DBS for Alzheimer's work? And of course, there was the promising results for certain of the patients around white matter and but it just wasn't consistent enough. And it wasn't predictable who was going to benefit. This has been the problem with depression too. Inconsistent result. There's no doubt certain people benefit, but can you identify the right patients and then get the right target and do the right programming?
Yeah. Of course. I mean, you probably always have to consider the marketing and not the marketing, the market factors of things, mm-hmm. right? So absolutely understand.
Well, like one of the conversations we have consistently with Dr. Okun is Tourette syndrome, because he's got a phenomenal database of people with Tourette's who have benefited from DBS. And we've never done an RCT on it. We've been looking into whether we can get humanitarian device exemptions so that at least it's possible to offer. But the problem with Tourette's is the market problem.
Hmm.
You know, it is never going to be a multi-million dollar market.
Yeah, so. Yeah. That is a huge problem also for OCD. I think there has to be some sort of, for smaller indications, that it is easier to get things, or like, you know,
completely.
Think if you'd, and I'm no expert in this, but I think, for example, lesioning does not have to be approved per site, if I'm informed correctly, but the device to make the lesion has to have an FDA approval. And so with DBS, it seems like it's very restricted to where you put the electrode, right? And
well, it's the same rules for everybody. The clinicians can prescribe DBS for whatever they like. The challenge will be, can they get reimbursed for it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can they get paid? And we can't train or promote on indications that aren't approved, obviously.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
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 All right. So yeah, still a lot to do there.
I know.
Do you, so we talked about eureka moments. I also always want to ask the opposite in a way. Do you regret anything in your professional life, or, you know, did something go really wrong once? And so
that I feel like I've made every mistake you can possibly make in career development, but I don't really have any regrets, because the things that went wrong were the things that you learned from the most. And so, you know, there's this thing about humans is we tend to only learn from our own mistakes. So you know, I've had some pretty embarrassing moments of, like, when I first became a people manager, I was such a bad boss that my only employee quit, you know. So
got it. Yeah.
But you learn from that too. And
sure.
So now one of the things I focus a lot on is professional and career development. I want to make sure that my team feels supported, that working on my team is a good place to work, that you're going to get developed as a human being, respected as a person. But one of the running jokes on my team is that, like, if you want to get pregnant, you should come work for me, because my team is full of babies, people with babies. Wow,
fantastic. That's great. Yeah.
So I love to support parents in their career development, kind of, and make sure that people have an opportunity to grow and be challenged in their careers. So I've been really proud of that. Yeah.
That's great. Any advice for young folks entering the field of neuromodulation at large? Could be industry, could be, you know, clinics. Any idea? Yeah.
I think the key to success in our field is curiosity. There is so much to learn.
Yeah.
And if you're a fundamentally curious person, this field is the most exciting in all of med tech, I think, because we're on the verge of being able to discover so many things and then make them really useful for people.
Yeah.
So stay curious. Know that if something doesn't work, it's okay. It's like the whole Thomas Edison. It's like, I've not failed. I found 10,000 things that don't work.
Yeah.
So fail forward, fail in the right direction, be willing to challenge the status quo and stand up for what you believe in. Because there's unlimited opportunity for discovery in our field.
Yeah, the brain is unlimitedly complex. Yeah. So yeah, lots to discover.
But this is the space for curious people.
Great. Well said. And any advice for folks that would maybe coming from academia or clinical work to land an industry job? Do you have any general suggestions?
Well, it's a little bit back to what we were talking about earlier in understanding the market dynamics. Just because something is a good idea doesn't mean that it's a good business. And so the reality is, on the business side, we have to prioritize. We have to make choices with the resources that we have. And that's the hardest part of my job, is deciding what to say no to. Mm-hmm. I would love to say yes to every idea that crosses my desk, and I can't. I have to choose.
Yeah.
Both because we don't have the resources, but also just the human capacity to do work. Yeah. And so when you come in from academia, it's hard not to get offended if your idea isn't the one chosen.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
That makes sense. Yeah.
So it's balancing the quality of the idea with the ability to sell it.
That's very helpful. But maybe even more, you know, for the younger folks, let's say postdocs from a lab, from my lab, from, you know, that want to go into industry, but may not be well connected yet, but might be great at what they do, either mm-hmm. R&D or more the business side. Any tips that you could give of how best to approach the companies, or meet at conferences, or what's a good tip maybe that you could give to young folks that would be curious?
So in general, I think this is true whether you are already part of an industry or wanting to enter an industry, networking is key. You can look at who's presenting posters, who's on podiums, who's behind the scenes, and get to know them. So, you know, in our research and technology area, we've got a phenomenal researcher, Abby Becker. So she worked in Peter Brown's lab and in Phil Starr's lab, and then she came to work for Medtronic, right? And she's kind of got the prototype of like the perfect career that transitions from academia to industry. Or Rob Rake. Rob did the same exact thing. So if you go and you know you want to do that, meet Rob, meet Abby, talk to them about how they did it, get to know them, because it's all humans.
Yeah.
Right. Just get to know the people that you might actually want to go work for, and ask for a job.
Sounds great.
We're a company of human beings. And when you, it's just make that human connection, demonstrate curiosity, and pretty soon, you know, we'll be dying to hire you.
Sounds great. Okay. And then we've talked about the future a bit, but if you had to paint the like bigger picture of where our field would be in maybe 10 or 20 years even, what do you think are the, you know, more long-term vision ideas there?
Well, I hope this isn't too narrowly bound, but I'm going to stay within the field of implantable neuromodulation, because I do think that's an amazing field with a lot of runway. But I can imagine a tiny, elegant, sensing-enabled device that, you know, that lasts for 20 years, that can sense and interpret your brain signals, that really does take all that we've learned and translate it into an elegant, seamless therapy for patients that they're more than willing to get, that we've gotten over the fear. We've got the tools now, we just need to make it a reality.
Sounds great.
Small, simple, elegant, physiologically responsive devices that change people's lives for the better.
Unless
we can cure the diseases. If we can cure them, that'd be even better. But I'll stay in my lane for a little bit. Yeah.
Totally. And then any missed opportunities that the field should be doing more but isn't doing enough?
Oh, man. I should have thought about this question. I don't have a good answer for you on this one. I mean, again, more research and more investment into the algorithms that make the brain work is always going to be beneficial.
Yeah. And no answer is a good one here, right? Because it seems like we're on track, at least. There's no apparent thing where you've always been thinking, oh, we should be doing that more, or, you know. I think that's a good answer
for us,
right? No apparent mistakes, at least. And I agree. I think we are sailing towards the right direction, and there's not much where I think, oh, this is all going wrong or so, right? I think
one thing I'll just say for Medtronic, we've got amazing imaging and visualization technology, and we've got amazing stimulation technology, and we haven't been as amazing at connecting those dots. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've got a great opportunity to take the tools that we have on the planning side and present them to the programming clinicians in a much more elegant way. I think Boston Scientific's done a nice job with that, but so that's, we have to invest some time there. We were focused on sensing.
I still think
was the right area of focus, but no, we've got to close the loop on the planning to programming side.
Sounds good. Cool. Mm-hmm. And then last question, is there anything we should have talked about that you would have loved to talk about that I missed or that we didn't cover enough?
Well, what are you most excited about in the field of neuromodulation?
Oh, great question. I think I can share. Great question. I think multiple things. I'm really excited about some indications, personally, really about depression and Alzheimer's. I kind of have been converted to become a believer in both when seeing the data. I was not before. So especially for Alzheimer's, to be honest, I was not. But I've grown to become a believer there, just looking at data and publishing on the data.
Yeah.
And then
I hope you're right, by the way. I really hope you're right.
Yeah. And I mean, this is a belief, right? This is not, but I've been swayed by the data to be much more positive about that potential indication. Then similarly, we talked about it. I did one paper with Mallory Hacker and David Charles on looking at their 14 cases. And I also became convinced at least that there is the need to investigate that further, the early indications. So
on the sweet spot targeting is really, really good.
So that, I think that's that paper. I'm sharing the last author on that. Yes. So I think the key point there, and I think we even unfortunately did not put that final figure into the paper. We're now sending off a second one to show that figure. I think if you just look at the raw contacts of the people that did not progress after 2 years, they're all so clustered in the sweet spot. And I think that's the most convincing thing to me, right? It could be chance, right? But there's no other thing that explains that, right? And they also had less stimulation amplitude and so on. So I think that's a very potentially very interesting field of development for early use of DBS. Mm-hmm. And I briefly mentioned this, fusing connectomics with sensing, I think, could be phenomenal. That's a bit more future work because we have to really decode brain states there, right? More like detecting tremor from the signals and then using that, or detecting speech and so on. So that might, there's still a lot of groundwork, but I think as a bigger vision, I think the way I currently see it, what closed loop would do, beta triggered closed loop would, you know, have a brake in a car that you could very fast and rapidly switch on and off. And that's a really cool steering mechanism already, because you have an adaptive brake that could, you know, steer the car really well, but it is limited to being a brake and not maybe switching gears in a way, right? Adaptively, which I would find very exciting to work on at some point too. Yeah.
Good.
So yeah, I'm generally very excited about the field, right? So I very much think there's so much cool stuff we can do in both academia and industry and together, hopefully as well. So
agreed. Completely. What else would we rather do? This is so fun, isn't it?
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah. So thank you so much, Ameza, one more time. I know how busy you are. I can imagine at least. And so this was really a big honor too.
This was a delight. Thank you. I'm beyond honored to be asked. And if you want to continue our conversation at any time in the future, just know I'm in this for the long haul.